so far around turns.
So you can see I've been gone all summer, and I even forgot about the opening chant. But when I was gone this summer, I spend my summers up in a cabin in northern Minnesota, reading the paper and thinking about my shrinking retirement, the cost of gas, all of the problems, etc. I reflected on how things are with our global economy, how things are changing so rapidly, and how it's very difficult for any of us to avoid the effects of rapid change. So what are we going to do? The problem, of course, is that we get so caught up in worrying about I get caught up in worrying about my shrinking retirement fund, the cost of gas, etc., that we get on automatic pilot, the way we run our lives. And there's a good reason for it. It gives us ways to respond. But as a result is that we're not mindful. We don't think about what we're doing. Now, the way of life that we actually practice here at the Zen Center, which we learn through the cultivation and practice of mindfulness, and I know there are a lot of people here who are here for maybe the first time or the first few times. So when I use the word mindfulness, and I'll describe it more fully later, it's just learning to be present and aware in the moment. And so we practice mindfulness, basically, and it's a way to actually open the door to live life more fully. But we get so caught up, again, we're so full of anxiety and tension because we're living in the moment that it's very difficult to do, very difficult to do. Does any of this apply to you? Does any of this apply to me? Is everyone immune from things like this? Well, all of us have, at the very least, we have brains and physical bodies, and therefore we're exposed to, all kinds of aspects of the human condition. We know we're going to grow old, and some of us are getting closer and closer. We know that death is inevitable. Many of us will be sick. We may have aging parents who we love dearly, we know are going to die. And this is all part of the human condition, etc. So we were all subject to these various problems, etc. And the question for us, particularly in a Zen center, is to ask, well, what are we going to do about it? How do we recognize what our suffering is? How do we handle these various experiences that come up for all of us. And I'm an old Clint Eastwood fan. And so I had that old cliche, that all of the good, the bad, and the ugly that comes up, if you will. So we practice mindfulness here. Mindfulness practice is more than just a neat idea or a really good philosophy. It's something we actually have to practice. And so this is a good time of year, basically, to take stock of our practice. And this is really the title of my talk, taking stock, basically, of the nature of our practice. The Zen Center has a certain rhythm. Labor Day weekend kind of starts a whole new series of classes and a whole new series of practice periods. And so it's really a good time to basically take stock. I actually give this talk most Labor Days. It's just a good way to take stock. Well, in thinking about our practice, and I know there are a lot of people here, again, without much experience, it's really good to have some kind of visual metaphor to think about our practice. So when you leave, you can think, well, what did he say? What should I remember? How am I going to work with this? And some of the ideas we're going to talk about are things that you're not going to resolve today, but they're things basically that you want to work on throughout the fall and throughout the year. And so for me, this is a year of reflection, really a year of taking stock. And I think a lot of us, you know, might want to think that way, if you will. So my visual metaphor, and I use the word cultivating, you know, where we actually cultivate and practice mindfulness. And so there's a lot of farming background in Buddhism. So I'm going to talk about gardening and use that metaphor. And so what do you have when you garden? Well, you have the soil, right, that you're going to plant. When you start, your garden is full of weeds and rocks, obnoxious weeds that have to be removed, right? We want to plant flowers. And so what are the nature of our flowers? We need rain and sun, actually, to help our flowers grow. And we also need compost, because we're Buddhist, right? No fertilizer, compost, basically, to help our flowers grow. So basically, what are some of these elements in Buddhism, and how do they relate to our practice? Well, to keep things simple, I want to think about, we'll talk about the Buddha's most basic teaching, his very first teaching after enlightenment. Just a little background. In his mid-20s, the Buddha went off as a seeker, and he was distraught with the human condition. And he searched for 6 years trying to decide what the problem was and what the solution to the problem was. And in doing this, he used an old Indian problem-solving formula. And that has four parts. And the first part is, what's the problem? If you don't know what the problem is, you can't solve it. Now, secondly, what's the solution to the problem? If you don't know what the solution is, you can't work to solve the problem. The second one is, what's the cause? First one, to start over. You know, what's the problem? Secondly, what's the cause of the problem? Third, is there a solution? And if so, what's its nature? And then the fourth really is the steps that you usually, that you can really use to work your way through, the resolution of that problem. And so in his enlightenment, now this is the way he framed his understanding of the human condition. And if we can go back to the garden imagery, that the first, and we call these the four great thoughts, and to make it simpler so you don't have to remember all these things, on the front of your brochure, I have the four great thoughts listed, and so you can just refer to those if you want. So after his enlightenment, the Buddha's understanding of the problem was the universality of suffering, the universality of suffering. This was the problem, it's our problem. But a part of our gardening is to understand, what suffering really means. And suffering is the weeds, the weeds that we're going to pull out of our garden. Okay. One of the best definitions I've run across myself for an explanation of what suffering is comes out of a book by Jon Kabat-Zinn, and he talks about Zorba the Greek. And now, many of you are too young to have seen Zorba the Greek. I was at a coffee house this morning, and I heard Elvis singing in the background. And I asked the two young women behind the counter, is that Elvis? And they say, I don't know. That's from the 50s and 60s. So I imagine they were all born about 1990, something like that. So you may not be familiar with Zorba the Greek. But Zorba was this exuberant character, and one of his companions says, Zorba, were you ever married? And Zorba says, married, of course. This is paraphrasing, of course. And he says, wife, kids, house, everything, the full catastrophe. And to me, that's just a great definition of suffering. Because we tend to take that word suffering in our culture to think just the bad things. You know, sickness, loss of a job, you know, something like that. Our parents die. But suffering also can be related to very good things. If you're a parent, for example, and I'm a parent with grandkids, and you look at one of your kids and say, geez, you know, Joey doesn't have a chance in the world. You know, what a daffy little kid. You know what I mean? How's it going to go? You love your parents, right? And they've been supportive of you. But they're getting older. They're getting older, and they might get ill, and they might die. And so it's stress and tension and anxiety in our lives that come from good things in our lives and not just from bad things. So when we think about the weeds in our life and the sources, the weeds are the tensions and the anxieties and the uncertainties, etc. You know, they come from the whole range of our experience. And so one of the first things we want to do in our practice is to recognize what are the weeds? What are the weeds in our garden? And when you start a practice, and hopefully many of you will be starting the practice, like tending a garden, one of the first things you have to do is prepare the bed. The bed is actually our physical body and our brain, okay? And that's what we have. And we have a house, and in front of the house, there's a certain part for a garden. It may be rocky and stony. It may not be very rich, but whatever, we start with basically what we have. And the very first thing we do is remove the weeds, etc., or at least try to, okay, in our practice. And so the first two great truths in the Buddhist teaching really have to do with the understanding of weeds and the causes of their flourishing basically in that garden. The third and fourth great truths are ways to recognize what a weed is and how you get them out and how you cultivate flowers, if you will. When I was a grad student, my wife and I moved into a cottage near a lake. I went to the University of Wisconsin. And full of energy, the first thing I did is I ran around the garden. I plucked all these weeds out and was going to make it look nice. And the owner came screaming up saying, "You plucked my wildflowers out." And I went, "Well, what did I know?" You know what I mean? And so it's not as easy to recognize what's a weed and often what's a flower. And so we actually have to approach this in a really mindful way, if you will. And so the third and fourth, again, is how we recognize this. And so we have our suffering. And the second great thought is, what's making the weeds flourish? And by the way, in Buddhism, we have all kinds of words for these things, but I'm not using those words. And most of the reasons basically come down to three things. They come down to attachment, dislike, and delusion. And attachment, an extreme form of attachment, basically is greed. But we have all kinds of ranges of attachment. And when I use the word attachment and dislike, I like to put the word excessive in front of them. Excessive attachment, excessive dislike, if you will. The Sufi poet Rumi said once, out beyond ideas of wrongness and rightness, there is a field. I'll meet you there. Okay? I like that, etc. The second of these causes of the growing of our weeds, dislike, in an extreme form, of course, is hatred or anger. But we have lots of dislike, excessive dislike, if you will. And to give you an idea about the difference between suffering and just normal actual things that happen, I like to use the idea of stubbing your toe. And up in my cabin, I get up at night and I kind of wander around, and we have a fireplace bottom that sticks out in a square, and I always hit that thing with my toe. And it's pain. We always have pain, okay? But that's pain. But what's suffering? Suffering is when I say, "Oh, guy, why did it happen to me? I did it again." Or if you hit something in the dark in your house, you say, "Why did she leave that out there? Or why did he leave that out there? Oh, woe is me, woe is me." And so the difference between the pain, basically, that we feel, which is real, and the suffering that we bring on through all these extra ideas about, "Oh, woe is me." And John Kabat-Zinn, with working with really chronically ill patients in medical situations, distinguishes between the cancer they have and all of this additional suffering that they bring to it. Why me? Why me? Oh, whoa. You know, on and on. And so this is the second grade. A lot of our weeds actually come through this kind of dislike. And then the third cause is just basically a delusion, you know, that we don't we tell storylines that try to justify the way we act, just storylines. I'm a great son because I visit my mom once a year. You know, I think you get the idea. Okay, if we look at the fourth noble truth, and this is kind of laying out the details of how we work with our suffering, there's what I'll call eight practices. Eight practices. And again, eight's a lot of numbers, and you come and I've already talked about four of these and three of these. And so again, they're kind of written down on your brochure. We usually organize them into three trainings, what we call three trainings. And one is a training in mindfulness, and a second is a training in morality, and the third is a training in clear seeing, okay? And we actually train, if you will, train. And if you look at the first little group of three, you'll see that there's right effort, and there's what I'm calling right concentration, and then there's a right bare awareness, if you will. These are the tools. These are the tools in right mindfulness that we use to cultivate our garden. Right concentration is what you learned upstairs if you took the class, where you concentrate on your breath, on the moment. There's a seed, if you will. And what you're trying to do in that kind of mindfulness training is to learn to stabilize the mind. If your garden, you have to be there, and you have to be able to work at what you're doing. In our practice of thinking about suffering, you have to learn to be present to what opens. You have to learn to be present. And so this is an important, necessary skill that we develop in our training, is how to stabilize our mind. And then the third part, that is bare awareness, and these are all part of mindfulness training, is really learning to be open. And I don't want to say that has three parts because there's another three. But we learn to be open to whatever arises in our mind. We learn to observe what arises. And we learn, in a sense, to be a witness, to actually sit back and see what arises. And then these are the three O's. We learn to look at everything in an objective way, a non-judgmental way, if you will. So you just see what arises. See what arises. Observe them. And, of course, this is the way we recognize the various kinds of weeds that are growing in our garden. And let me give you some examples of the kind of weeds that actually grow in gardens. And these are kind of automatic kind of types of behavior. Oftentimes, we're the only one who's unaware of them. All of our friends can look at us and tell us exactly what's wrong, you know, all of our bad ideas, if you will. Exactly. So one is, and this is one of my weeds I've had to work with, and that is we were taught to be busy. To be idle is not good. So we're busy, busy, busy. We're so busy we don't have time for our family or our friends. You know what I mean? And we're absent. We're absent. So this is a typical kind of weed that grows up. Another weed that many of us have basically is not letting somebody finish their conversation. And they start to talk, and we know what they're going to say, right? And so we jump in and interrupt them. And Rosemary once told me there are two parts of a conversation. One part is talking, and the other part's waiting to talk. And in this particular case, you can't even wait for the other person to be quiet, and so you interrupt. This is a weed, and we can all get rid of those weeds. A third example, which is related to that, basically, is not listening fully and compassionately what the person says. And so you're talking to somebody, and they say, "Well, I just came back from the Boundary Waters canoe area canoeing. And I had a great time." And so you say, "Oh, let me tell you about the time I was up there." And of course, they want to tell you about their experience. And instead, you change the conversation. Another one is that you're part of a group and you come in and you want to dominate it for various reasons. But there are all kinds of other examples of weeds that grow up. You're never on time. Or worse, like me, with a Catholic background, you're always early. Okay? And there are all kinds of things that you suddenly, by observing yourself through mindfulness practice, you become aware, basically, of these weeds growing in your garden. Oftentimes, all of these habits that we're talking about, basically, oftentimes are you know, you're not aware of them. They're automatic responses. If we go to the second set of trainings, and this is morality, the training in morality, and I think of morality as just the extent to which one approaches the broader social whole and the earth itself with compassion. It's a simple definition, etc. That there's some, and there are three parts to it: right speech, right action, and right livelihood. And just a few examples from right speech. Well, oftentimes, right speech is simply defined as don't lie. But of course, it means much more. It means don't talk in a hurtful way. Don't talk in a hurtful way. And oftentimes we have automatic ways of talking that are hurtful. We shut someone off. We ignore them, etc. So don't talk in a hurtful way. But the other part is to learn to listen compassionately. You know, so that when you talk with somebody, you're nourishing them. Okay? And wonderful examples of the weeds that can grow out of uncompassionate talk are in Marshall Rosenberg's wonderful book called Nonviolent Communication. And he gives two examples of weeds and many, many more. One example is moralistic judgments, in which you're always blaming somebody else for your problems. You know, why did he do that? And it might not be a person, it could be a situation. You know, why do I have to live here, you know, if you will? You know, these kinds of ideas. So these are moralistic kinds of judgments. Another weed that he sees in his garden is the weed of comparison. You know, where you compare yourself to others. You know, I have more money, or you like somebody because they have a bigger house. I mean, so there's all these kinds of comparisons. If you're into comparisons, one way to become cured, you know, is to read Dan Greenberg's book, a wonderful book called How to Make Yourself Miserable. I don't know if anyone's read the book, How to Make Yourself Miserable. And so he has a section on comparisons. And the first thing he suggests you do is take a picture, a photograph of yourself, particularly in a very skimpy bathing suit. And then take a picture of, you know, some ideal woman or man and compare yourself. Okay, and then he says, well, let's compare your achievements to others. And he pretends that he's fingering through the telephone book at random, just picking names out at random. And the first names he comes up with is Mozart. See, Amadeus. You know, and Amadeus, of course, by the age of 12, had created great music, spoke numerous languages. And then Greenberg goes through the telephone book again, picks out another name, Einstein. Albert, you know, so I think you basically kind of get the idea. And so these basically are the kinds of weeds that can come up. If we actually look at the third kind of training, and this is the training basically in clear seeing, and it has all kinds of names, but that's pretty straightforward. And there are two parts of it. And one part is right understanding, and the other part is right thinking or right intent. The way you bring this stuff forward. Our people think, well, what's right understanding? But in Buddhism, it's really understanding basically how to be mindful, how to grow your roses, how to cultivate your garden, if you will. It's not knowing everything in an encyclopedia. That's not what Buddhist wisdom is about. And so what kind of weed might we find? Well, one weed basically is not understanding how to meditate. In a very helpful way. You can sit here for 30 years, and I think I've been here since 76 off and on, so maybe longer than that, you know, you're not going to meditate in a fruitful way. And so what's that mean? Since what's really been helpful The 1990s in medical research is known as the decade of the brain. And it really started in the 1980s with Richard Davidson at the University of Wisconsin, who wanted to study happiness. And he had to do it surreptitiously because everyone studied what was wrong with the person, right? And so he'd get this money and he'd sneak this research in. He started to work with the Dalai Lama and some of his advanced meditators to see what was the difference between a happy brain, and I use the word happy, an enlightened brain, if you will, a normal brain, and a really unhelpful one. And during the 90s, there was just a tremendous amount of research. And today, there's not a major medical research center that does not have a mindful institute, etc. You can get on the web, and there's mindfulkids.org, for example, and they're introducing mindfulness into grade schools. Of course, in some parts of the country, you can't use the word mindful because it reminds people of Buddhism, right? So they use the word reflection. And people have suggested that rather than the 3 hours, we need a 4 hours in our school, 4 hours, reading, writing, arithmetic, and reflection, if you will. Because people don't learn to reflect, basically. They don't look at the weeds, etc. They don't think consciously of the flowers that they're growing, right? This training, which has really come out of Buddhism, has really spread widely throughout the West. But one aspect of these brain studies is to see what happens when you meditate in different ways. If you sit there and meditate and you're thinking, you're planning, that activity. I'm not going to go into the parts of the brain. I'm planning to give a talk on the biology of happiness later in the year to actually go over some of these studies, because there's no better inspiration for practicing and to understand why it works and how it works, if you will. But you think in your meditation, and it's up here in the wrong part of the brain. You come mindful where you're just open and present in the very moment, and it activates different parts of the brain, which turn out to be the seat of things like calmness, compassion, all of the social virtues, the flowers. These are the flowers, in my view, that we want to cultivate. Loving kindness, a joy for the accomplishments of others, compassionate listening, etc. Well, all of these comes out of a certain part of the brain, etc. Back to the seed part, recognizing weeds, perhaps you don't understand what you're doing in meditation, how you meditate, and actually how it affects the brain, etc. Okay? Well, we've talked a lot about weeds, and I mentioned when we start our practice, we do a lot of garden clearing, and this is just the nature of it. A lot of people start meditation, and they figure, wow, I'm going to be calm, I'm going to be relaxed, and they don't realize that they've got all those weeds are there. And they come up and they get in the way, and you've got to handle them. Okay? Let's talk a little bit about what goes into the compost. What goes into the compost to help us grow these flowers, if you will, of compassion and loving kindness and things like this, etc. I call it compost, etc. And these are the things that are going to enrich our soil. I can't remember them all. But some, for example, are patience. I'll mention that some of them I'm going to talk about. Patience, trust, non-striving, acceptance, letting go, non-judging, etc. This is all part of the compost that we can actually develop and work on. For example, patience. We know from brain studies that it takes a while. I'm not going to go into detail. It takes a while to actually dismantle old reactive patterns and to actually build in new ones. And just a little peep into all of that. When we do things, there are various patterns that are developed in our brain along neuron synaptic pathways. And this really has an evolutionary benefit because when situations come up, we've learned automatic ways to respond. But we can also learn bad ways to respond, which are the weeds, cutting somebody off, not being attentive. And these become really literally embedded habits, because they're embedded into these synaptic pathways, etc., if you will. So it takes a while, and you can learn basically how to change those pathways, and it takes time. So one needs patience, if you will. Another is non-striving. And that's there are wonderful paradoxes in Buddhism, non-striving. The idea is, if you strive, the idea of mindfulness is to be present right here in the moment. And if you're striving, you're not in the moment. You're looking ahead. And another way to think about it is, if you're striving, you're thinking. You're thinking, right? And if you're mindful, you're out of your head. Right? And so we strive but non-strive, and I'll say a little bit more about that in a minute. Another part of the compost is acceptance, and that is accepting who and what we are. That is looking at our garden, looking at the weeds, recognizing them, realizing that to actually grow flowers, we have to remove the weeds. We may not like what we see when we look at ourselves, and all the weeds we have. We may not like it, etc. But remember, the very first great thought of the Buddha is the universality of suffering. And so part of it is learning to recognize through mindfulness what's there and accept it, so we can work with it. If we don't look at it and accept it, then we can't basically work with it. Another is letting go. When I talked about basically the three ways that we grow weeds, I mentioned attachment. And when I think of these kind of things, I like to have an image in my mind that I can work with when I sit, work with, that's really embedded in my body. And I always come back to this story about the way they used to catch monkeys in ancient India. They would take a pottery bowl with a little neck, and then they would put some peanuts on the bottom. And the monkey would come and put her paw in there and grab those peanuts and form a fist. And, of course, with a fist, you can't get out, and they would grab the monkey. To flee, all the monkey had to do was open the fist and let go. And so when I think about my attachments, am I able to let go? And I actually sit there and I think, is my fist clenched around those peanuts and I can't let go? And it's really something that, if you sit with it and think about it, it really becomes very part, very part of your practice, etc., to get that feeling of not letting go. So we have to learn to let go. When I talked about stubbing your toe, of course, it hurts. There is pain. But what we have to learn to let go is the suffering that we generate. The oh me, oh poor me stuff. Another bit of our compost is non-judging. That what comes up, again, remember, that we're not using our moralistic judgment. We're not comparing. We're just observing what is, whatever comes up, etc. And then the last is trust, and that is that we need an element of trust that this is going to work, that if we stick with it, this is going to go up. And to me, there are two really sources of really support for this idea of trust. And one is that Buddhism is 2,500 years old, and there are all kinds of great Buddhists, etc., and other people who have done mindful practice, who shows you, yes, this happens. Okay, so we have examples. And then the second area are the brain studies I was talking about that show you, yes, and all of these studies say, yes, this happens. And they are not sure why it always happens, but they can demonstrate basically that it happens. The last part of the compost that I think is a really big one is personal vision. I used to think that you could come and sit and meditate you know, have no personal. All you had to do was sit there. All of these things basically would just come up. You know, all of these weeds would go, roses would grow. All you had to do was come and sit. And over the years, I've realized that you need commitment. You need a reason to sit. You have to know why you're sitting. And so you make this, you need a personal vision, etc. And if I go back to my garden metaphor, we know we can develop these various kind of flowers, if you will. We know we can develop them, etc. And everyone has different visions of what a garden should look like. And so what do you want to become? What do you want to be? And to me, a personal vision is a very important one. There's a paradox, of course, and I mentioned Buddhism is full of paradoxes. And one is, when you're being mindful, you can't have that personal vision there because it's thinking, right? You're not in the moment. You're not embedded in your body. So I always tell people when we talk about these things, or write this down on a piece of paper. And then when you start your practice, lock it in a drawer and forget it. Okay, locking in the drawer. So, you know, there's kind of a problem there, but you got to get it out of your mind. You can't think it. Remember non-striving, etc., if you will. So each of us has a choice, and we can decide, in a sense, what we want to be. In the old monasteries, there wasn't much choice, and it was very ritual full, if you will. And there's a wonderful book that Steve Heine, I shouldn't mention books, I'll just give the name. It's this called Zen Ritual, in which it goes into the fullness of the ritual and how basically what you're trying to do is produce a certain kind of Zen monk, etc. And you think about these learned behaviors and how the brain changes, etc. It's really interesting what's going on. We don't live in a monastery, and so we have more choice. Now, what about our practice? There are all kinds of ways of being mindful. Yoga, Tai Chi, Qigong, a centering prayer in Christianity. You can wash the dishes and being mindful. The idea is to be present. I had a wonderful book I've lost track of called something like Zen in the Household. And it talked about sweeping and cleaning and, you know, how you can be mindful, etc. Zen practice is just one possibility. But most of us find that it's more useful, basically, to be in a more formal practice, to have more structure, particularly when we're starting. I'll just mention three possibilities that kind of end what I'm talking about. The first is John Kabat-Zinn's various books, and I have one here, Full Catastrophe Living. And what he does in this book is he lays out a formal 8-week meditation practice. He explains very simply and fully what I'm talking about, what embedded meditation is, how you get more in touch with your body, if you will. And then there's at least 6 CDs related to the book, and 4 are guided meditations. If you take that program, you commit yourself to sitting at least 45 minutes 6 days a week. And to make it easier, at least in the beginning, you use his CDs, 45 minutes. And he starts with body scanning, and then he does some yoga. And the idea is you want to really get out of the head and get in touch with the body. His second book, which I really like, is called A Coming to Our Senses. And there's a play on words there. Coming to our senses means, let's get with it, right? But coming to our senses means get out of the head, come right back into the body, come to our senses, etc. And there are many more than the 5 senses we're familiar with, such as smell and touch, etc. There's the idea of what's going on in your mind and in other people's mind, and that's called mindsight, if you will. There's the idea of the space and what's going on in your body, and that's called interoception, etc. So there are lots of different possibilities, if you will. So if you like a structured approach that's based upon Buddhism but doesn't use the B word except for the introduction, John Kabat-Zinn is a good choice. And it's universally used now. Another choice is, I mentioned, we usually don't think of this, is Marshall Rosenberg's book, A Nonviolent Communication. There's a workbook that comes with it, and again, there's at least six CDs that come with it if you're the type that doesn't want to read about this. And we've talked about the weeds that he talks about, moralistic judgments. We've talked about comparative thinking. But he also spends most of his time actually talking about how do you listen compassionately? These are flowers and roses that grow. How do you nourish a person? And like all of these practices, it's not sufficient to sit on your mat. If you're practicing, for example, compassionate listening, you have to get up and go out and listen to people. You have to work with people. If you're working with loving kindness, you have to not, you can think about it on the map, but you've got to go out and practice and interact with it. Okay? That's an essential part of our practice. And so Marshall Rosenberg's another very good one. You can practice it all the time because you're talking with people all the time. Are you listening? How supportive are you in what you're saying? And then the third area I'll mention, of course, is the Zen Center itself. And I mentioned that we're starting a whole new cycle. And in this week, we have all kinds of new classes and in the fall. And so you might want to look at that. For example, David Benson and Judy Simmons are teaching a course on a meditation for beginners. If you've had no experience, it's a great place to start. It's an introductory course. James Wellman is teaching embodied meditation, what I've been talking about, what I consider mindfulness. How do you get out of your mind and into your body, etc. Our practice period, our two-month practice period this fall is on meditation, taught by Tim Burkett and Lee Lewis. And I might mention we have wonderful teachers here. Cindy Ritter will be teaching her... I will be teaching her depression and mindfulness course. All of this, by the way, is in your brochure, and Dan will be saying something about it. There's more. We have an introductory course on Zen basics if one is interested in learning about the history and the basic ideas of Zen. We have practice periods, intensive meditation periods. You have to practice. And at the end of this month at our country place, Hokioji, that there's about a week's meditation period. And then we have sittings in the morning and the evening. We also have the opportunity to actually visit and talk with Tim Burkett, the abbot, or one of our teachers here. So, and there's much, much more, and Dan will say something about that. Okay, in ending, I just go back to my gardening metaphor. And that is when you, if you're thinking about starting a practice again, we come back to what's the soil, what's the nature of the weeds, etc. What's the compost that we add to it, etc. What kind of flowers can we grow? One thing I haven't emphasized is the rain and the sun that's so necessary to grow a garden, and that's the whole range of our experience, good and bad, etc. And so in the next. During the fall, and again, you can't do it today, it's really a time to take stock, to reflect, to really make some decisions about what your practice might be. Okay, thank you. Dan's going to have some announcements. Oh, questions. See, I've been gone too long. Any comments about tending a garden? Or any questions that a person may have?
It's not a question, it's a comment, so you're on the book.
Good.
I really appreciate the compost idea. I remember before I moved here and I lived in Michigan and lived out in the country, and I had a birthday party, and we were playing hide and seek. There were farm buildings and trees and lots of great places to hide, and I found a great place, and I was all squatted down in this area, and I was thinking, what is that? No. I was right by the compost. I was like in between the two boxes.
Right, there it was, yeah.
And it's stinky. We need patience, we need trust, we need letting go because it's stinky, this stuff that
right.
Helps us grow. It's unpleasant.
That's right. Any other comments or questions? The things I've been talking about, obviously, almost every part of it we could talk forever on. And that's why you take courses, and that's why you talk with people. you know, what are the flowers and how do you recognize what a flower is? You know, how do you work with the weeds? You know, everything. Nonviolent communication is takes effort and effort and effort. And you can work on it for years and then you hear yourself saying something harmful. You know what I mean? Harmful, etc. So there's just a great area.